5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino?
Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto.
I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, and I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm here. That's how I am.
I'm just really happy to be talking about movies and maybe whether Sonny is better than AI or not with friends.
We'll get to that. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. All right. Many thanks, as always, to the folks who are listening on Tuesday, as you are helping to keep this thing sustainable. If you enjoy what you see, maybe like hit the like button on these posts or like repost. I don't know. What do they call it on Substack? Reposting?
Restacking.
With a note. Restack with a note. Do that. That's helpful for the algorithm. And we all worship at the bone temple of the algorithm. It's all that's going to be left in a million years. So, you know, we'll get to bone temples. We'll get to algorithms, whatever. Maybe that's a controversy or an controversy. But one thing that we know is a controversy.
Hamish from Substack, Rafe Fiennes?
I don't know Hamish well enough, frankly.
Hamish, are you coating yourself with iodine and blasting a lot of vinyl? We can ask. Many mysteries will be revealed.
Yes, yes. All right, let's get on to controversies and non-controversies and talk about Kathleen Kennedy's tenure as head of the Lucasfilm subsection of Disney. She is out. She finally is ending her run as head of Lucasfilm. She took over when George Lucas sold the company to Disney and has been the de facto head of all things Star Wars and Indiana Jones these last 13 years or so. We could get into discussions about who is in charge of what and what role Bob Iger is playing in all of this, because there's no shortage of Disney hierarchy questions. But, you know, she's been in charge of Disney, Disney Star Wars efforts. And I think we can describe her tenure as charitably a rocky one. Look, undeniable wins. She's had some undeniable wins. The sequel trilogy kicked off with a bang, right? You had The Force Awakens, which remains the highest grossing domestic release of all time at $936 million, unadjusted for inflation. I feel fairly confident saying that nothing will ever approach that number again. I don't know. I have a hard time thinking that movie theaters will recover to the extent that anything will ever challenge that. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. And then there was the prequel trilogy that had left everybody kind of disappointed. Force Awakens comes in, makes a ton of money, follows that up with Rogue One, which was an unexpected phenomenon. I think it's easy to forget how, like, there were very mixed expectations on Rogue One. They're like, oh, well, this isn't part of the story. It's a Star Wars story. What's that? I don't know. Grossed $1 billion worldwide. Again, big hit. $1 billion. Then The Last Jedi comes out and it does fine at $1.3 billion. We'll return to it in a minute. The other undeniable hit that Disney had under her tenure, The Mandalorian. Disney needed something to come out of the gate hot for Disney Plus. The Mandalorian absolutely crushed it, must watch, drove lots of signups, showed that Star Wars could work on the small screen, and didn't necessarily need the Skywalker saga at its heart to move forward. We'll see how the movie version of this does in the spring. I'm actually really curious about this, because I think people have been kind of trained to think, okay, well, Mandalorian, that's a TV thing. But maybe they show up in theaters. I don't know. We'll see how it does. And she deserves a lot of credit for letting the guy who will replace her, Dave Filoni, take the reins on that show and just run with it. On the whole, though, I think it is also fair to say that her tenure is marked more by failures than successes. Yes, The Last Jedi made money, but it also demonstrated that no one at Lucasfilm had any control over what was nominally supposed to be the heart of this franchise. That sequel trilogy was a disaster. It was a disaster, not because the movies were bad, though I think we were outliers, the three of us, who did not like The Last Jedi critically. In the broader Star Wars community, it was more mixed than the critics. Critics loved it, went nuts for it. Audiences were kind of like, what? And I think as time has gone on, the audience portion of that has won out. But like, she hired Colin Trevorrow to make the third film, fired him, brought J.J. Abrams back. He spent most of his movie undoing what Rian Johnson had undone in his movie. No control over the series on a corporate level. No control. She hired and fired the Lord and Miller team for Solo, which I think led to some real corporate paralysis, because we've now gone 7 years between Star Wars movies. I cannot imagine that is what Disney wanted, certainly. I know it's not what the fans wanted, but like, Disney spent $5 billion on this thing. They want movies. They want movies that will earn money at the box office.
I mean, you don't have to imagine here, because Wired published an article way back when, after Disney's acquisition, in which they said quite explicitly that Disney's plan was for a new Star Wars movie every year, or just about every year, and that just has not happened.
They seem to be doing a pretty good job of that at first. Now, again, there are problems here that I think are not specifically Kathleen Kennedy's, right? Like, Solo comes out 6 months after The Last Jedi came out. That was a disappointment on top of a disappointment, which, you know, these things multiply in the public mind. If it had come out in December, I think that movie does better, frankly. Bob Iger wanted it in the May period. They got it in May period. It was not right. Anyway, the TV shows, aside from The Mandalorian, have floated somewhere between skippable and disastrous, right? It's not quite as bad as whatever it is that Paramount is doing with Star Trek. We haven't even touched on that debacle over there. It's a nightmare. But it's not far off. There's an ideological dimension to some of the complaints about Kennedy, namely that she's force-feeding the demon wokeness into Star Wars. And I think some of that is overstated, but it's not like those people imagined her parading around in a Forces Female t-shirt, which co-opted a Nike branding effort to do some Star Wars synergizing. Setting all that aside, setting all the ideological stuff aside, because I think there's a lot of Rorschach test with her there. There were so many projects, Alyssa, that got announced and simply never got made, that never even got close to being made, right? Like, there was a Patty Jenkins movie. There was a Rian Johnson trilogy. Yep. There was a Taika Waititi film. There was a Donald Glover Lando show. Over and over and over, we were told stuff was coming. Here's a big, exciting announcement. We're going to do a whole presentation about it. And then it just never happened. That is an abject failure of executive leadership, is it not?
Absolutely. And I think the bigger problem with Kathleen Kennedy's tenure at Lucasfilm has been a schizophrenic sense about what in Star Wars is appealing to the core fans and also to sort of a wider viewership. And the reason that the sequel trilogy was such a disappointment is it was a straight rehash of the original trilogy. And look, the original trilogy is among my favorite movies of all time. I mean, my experience watching those on VHS with my cousin was just one of the galvanic pop culture experiences of my life. But I think the reason that a lot more Star Wars was exciting and interesting to hardcore fans like me was not that we wanted to narrowly follow the hero's journey of Luke Skywalker or Luke Skywalker stand-in over and over again, but because we wanted to see what was going to unfold in this vast world that George Lucas had created. And there are aspects of the new Star Wars era that get that, right? I mean, Sunny, you said that the TV shows range between sort of awful and skippable. And I think the huge exception to that for me is Andor, which is maybe the only sort of Kennedy era piece of the franchise that really tried to sort of broaden that universe and that was interested in, you know, playing beyond the force that gives dimension to a character from the original trilogy, Mon Mothma, in a way that is, you know, anchored by a genuinely great and engaging performance. Stellan Skarsgård is wonderful in that. It's politically sophisticated and interesting. But yeah, it's, you know, I think that the Kennedy era was defined by a combination of timidity about venturing out into that larger world and an inability to say, you know, we're going to make something for kids here and adults here, but we're going to keep expanding, right? Like, this is going to keep getting bigger. And, you know, that's a bummer, right? I mean, there's also just the challenge of the expanded universe stuff, which I am very attached to. I know that, you know, most people, most normal, sane, well-functioning adults are not, you know, don't have like real strong feelings about whether or not like you do the Thrawn trilogy or whatever. But I just felt like Kathleen Kennedy didn't like or want to run Star Wars for the same reasons that I liked watching it. And I'm not, you know, sort of solely representative of the broader fandom, but I just don't think she had a clear sense of what she wanted Star Wars to be. And in addition, that probably informed a lot of the management challenges, right? Like, if you don't have a clear sense of the story that you want to tell, the brand identity, it's going to be hard to keep things moving along. But that combination of mismanagement and sort of misunderstanding, I think, really make this a lost era.
Filoni is an interesting replacement because I think Dave Filoni does have a fairly clear idea of what he wants Star Wars to be. But I also think that I'm nervous. I would say that I'm nervous about Dave Filoni's tenure as Star Wars, because as good as The Mandalorian is, it does have a tendency to get bogged down in like extended universe minutiae and fan service. There was a report out that, you know, this has been reported several different places and ways, but that he was not a fan of Andor, for instance, which I agree. I skipped over Andor. It is clearly the best of, it is the most artistically successful of the Kennedy era Star Wars products, almost certainly.
Yeah.
And actually did hit some of the ratings, you know, high marks for what has been on Disney Plus for Star Wars. But the problem with Filoni is that he is very much into like, hey, remember that character that we heard about once 15 years ago in a book? Let's get that guy. You remember that side character from a cartoon? Can we get him his own show? Yeah. Maybe that'll work. And that could be just as self-defeating.
100%.
Well, it's interesting because Filoni is in some ways the person who has shepherded Star Wars the best over the past decade during the Kennedy era. But he has shepherded it into something that I think it certainly wasn't the intent and is probably not right for Star Wars in a lot of ways, or not right for being the main thing that Star Wars is. It's an interesting tributary of Star Wars. And I think he's always been best when he's doing his cartoons and, you know, sort of doing these things that are not designed to have a true mass audience in the way that a Star Wars feature film is designed to kind of hit all four quadrants in the biggest possible way to be the biggest domestic, domestic film ever, right? Just like The Force Awakens was. That is what a Star Wars feature film can do. That is not what Filoni is trying to do. And so I think in some ways, to tie these things together, the way you can judge Kathleen Kennedy's tenure is that when she took over Star Wars, the first movie that came out was the biggest domestic box office success ever, maybe never to be beaten, at least not by, you know, when you adjust for inflation. The second film that came out 1 year later was this thing that you were talking about, Sonny, Rogue One, that people like, they were a little confused by it. It didn't seem like it obviously fit inside the Star Wars tradition, at least as we knew it. What was this going to be? And it was still a gigantic box office hit. And then some more movies kind of trickled out, and there has not been one since 2019. That wasn't the plan. We know because, like I said, there's this kind of incredible Wired article that's great to revisit about how the plan was a movie every year. But also, you don't buy Star Wars and then not make Star Wars movies. What she has done is she has turned this into fundamentally a television franchise for a very particular kind of obsessive fanboy. And I even resemble that kind of obsessive fanboy at some time. So this is not exactly an insult, but like that is what Filoni is doing. And when you watch Filoni talk about Star Wars, that guy, yes, it's his job now, but even in the early days, that guy knows every single thing that has ever happened in Star Wars and can explain it in these sort of beautiful gushing kind of like he loves every little moment, even the terrible moments, even the things that everybody kind of understands are cringe and silly. And part of his job, part of, I think, the way he conceives his job is to explain why those moments that are kind of goofy from especially like the prequel trilogy, the Lucas films, he's trying to rescue them. And he does in certain ways. But what Kennedy did by failing to lead this franchise and failing to have a clear, big, popular vision from the start, and by failing to say to the directors, here is our plan. This is what we're going to do for a trilogy. This is how these pieces are going to connect to each other. What she has done is she has taken this mass popular franchise, this IP that should be $1 billion every year, pretty much guaranteed. She's left it in a place where, first of all, there were no movies for 7 years, and now one's coming out in 5 months. And we don't know how big a hit it's going to be. I don't think it's going to be a total disaster or just a complete flop. But it's now not clear that this is going to be a $1 billion film. And that was a lock. They had $1 billion movies every year on lock, and she ruined that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Look, say what you will about J.J. Abrams and The Force Awakens and it being kind of a soft reboot, remake, rehash, whatever. That's an entertaining movie. That thing moves. It is fun. It looks good. Depending on how much you like the J.J. Abrams lens flare thing, I've always.
But the special effects are quite high quality, and they did some stuff, to kind of ground that film in physical effects. They actually built some sets. There was this kind of sense that Lucas had overshot with the CG in the Phantom Menace films, right? That it was just too much, and that this was going to sort of return to, the what people loved about the original, which was the physical effects work and kind of and world building.
Yeah.
And J.J. Abrams, as somebody, I have issues with The Force Awakens, but it's clearly a great business proposition. And he's also somebody who is always really, really good at starting a long story. And that franchise went off the rails partly when they brought Johnson on to do a sequel. And Johnson was like, my sequel is going to be about how I have issues with Star Wars and Star Wars fans. That's a bad idea for a giant franchise. But then it really went off the rails when they brought J.J. Abrams, who, like, I think I've seen him admit this. I think he said things like, I kind of struggle with endings. He is the worst writer of endings. In the popular, the world of popular storytelling in the last 50 years. He has never written an ending that anyone likes, I think, including him. And she brought him on to fix the ending to a trilogy with not nearly enough time left. Right. I mean, that was that part of the problem there wasn't just, oh, it's a different person. It's a compressed schedule. And the result is an absolute just dog's breakfast of like it's just a total, total mess. It's barely watchable, awful movie. And that didn't have to happen. You could have made even just a pretty good movie and it would have made a whole lot of money. And Kathleen Kennedy, that's on her. That's on her and to a lesser extent on J.J. Abrams. No one had to do that. She was the one who made that decision.
Yeah.
Yep. And it was bad.
It was bad. I mean, look, and again, J.J. Abrams makes the first Star Wars sequel. It's pretty good. Rogue One comes out and it's, both... It's shot by Gareth Edwards, right? Or Evans?
Yep.
I forget. I always forget
Edwards.
My Gareth.
Gareth Edwards.
Gareth Edwards. And then kind of reshot by Tony Gilroy, right? And there was a lot of work there. But like two good filmmakers who have their own strengths and kind of combined to make something that, again, is just really good. It's just a really good and good-looking movie. And say what you will about Rian Johnson. Again, the big problem with The Last Jedi is that it should have ended 20 minutes before it did. It should have ended on a cliffhanger instead of with everything else. But again, it's a movie that looks good. It looks
Mary
good.
Mary Poppins, we're all going to ride the magic broom into the sunset. Ugh.
It's pretty, it's a good looking movie. It's well acted, et cetera. Like
it makes very good use of Adam Driver.
It's, yeah. it's, But then everything just goes off the rails. Anyway, all right. So exit question here. Which of the non-completed, non-attempted, but announced properties is the one that you most wish we had actually gotten to see? As I've got an answer here. I'm curious if you guys have thought about this at all. I did not prep you for this question, so you can just invent a project that never got made. If you want,
Patty Jenkins X-Wing movie, like, no question. I my hope was that they would have adapted the actual X-Wing books, but like, Patty Jenkins is the daughter of an Air Force pilot. She's really into planes. I think she's a good director. I was just really bummed that one never came to fruition.
Yep. Peter.
So a couple that you didn't mention, just so that people understand how many of these things there are. The Game of Thrones guys, Benioff and Weiss, were signed to do a trilogy. Like, that was announced. Kevin Feige was going to do a... Yep, they were done with Game of Thrones. They were the hottest ticket in Hollywood. They were going to make Confederate and solve the... Yeah, right? They were going to make Confederate. It was going to be the next big HBO property. Yeah, and then... they made the Three-Body Problem. Those guys made the Three-Body Problem. Right. And there's another season coming out. At least, I don't remember exactly how many Netflix signed off on. Anyway, so we got that one.
Look,
we also got... Kevin Feige Star Wars movie that was going to happen. Because again, he was a hot ticket, right? He was running Marvel, and he was clearly just like the genius producer behind the scenes. He was going to make it happen. I'm obviously very interested in those films. But the one, of course, that I want to see is the one that all the real nerds want to see, which is The Hunt for Ben Solo, which is an Adam Driver starring Steven Soderbergh film. Like, am I going to pick a different... I want to see the Steven Soderbergh Star Wars movie. He's never done a big franchise film like that. Closest thing is, you know, the Oceans movies. But his Oceans movies, it's so amazing. This is a guy who is like, sometimes I'm going to make Schizopolis, and it's going to be completely impenetrable to all but like 14 viewers. And sometimes I'm going to make Ocean's 11, like a remake of an old Hollywood film that is just absolutely like the easiest, like most frothy, most popular, like, it's a thing that can just appeal to basically every kind of movie viewer, and is also be critically acclaimed and have great acting and look beautiful and all that. You want to see him take on Star Wars.
Yeah, that would have been a good one. I'm curious to see if we ever get the Donald Glover Lando show, because he, you know, that had been announced. It was going to be showrun by Justin Simien, who's the guy who made Dear White People. My understanding is Donald Glover not a big fan of that show, or it's what I've heard anyway. And he was not consulted before the announcement was made, which seems like to have been a bad choice. But theoretically, he and his brother were working on a Lando series, and I would very much like to see that. Donald Glover, very talented guy. He's got charm to spare. I really liked his Mr. and Miss Smith show. Like, that was a lot of fun. I think he's undergone some health problems. There was he had a stroke or something. Not ideal, but I do hope I would like to see a Lando show with Donald Glover. So that would be fun. All right. Make sure you swing by our bonus movieisle.substack.com for our bonus episode on Thursday. We're gonna be talking about zombies. So just some zombie talk, man, because we can't get enough of zombies. There's so many zombies out there, different kinds, different stories about zombies. All right, now on to the main event.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
28 years later, The Bone Temple. I've had some folks ask if they can watch The Bone Temple without having seen the preceding film. And I don't know what to say to them, except no, don't, like, you can't see the sequel before you see the first one. It won't make sense. So don't go to The Bone Temple if you haven't seen 28 years later. It just doesn't make sense. This movie picks up more or less right where the previous one left off. And as I'm just going to say, there's going to be spoilers talk because we got to talk about what happens also in the previous film and what's going to happen in this one. So if you're worried about spoilers, shut us off now. Come back after you've seen the movie. You should go see it. I liked it a lot. I don't know about a listen, Peter, but you should go see it anyway. So the movie picks up more or less right where the previous one left off. Spike has been captured by a gang of toughs who are dressed like Jimmy Savile, who go by the name the Jimmies, and they are about to fight Spike to the death. As the film begins, it's going to be one-on-one battle to the death, and you won't have any idea what's going on with the Jimmies or with Ralph Fiennes as Dr. Kelso and his relationship to the big nude alpha zombie. Samson, you won't understand it. So go watch the original, watch the first one 28 years later. It's on Netflix now, and then go watch the movie and then listen to this because we're about to discuss it. All right. So the first 28 years later, directed by Danny Boyle, is definitely a little weirder than this one on just a strict formal level, right? That movie had lots of editing tricks and fun camera work. This film, which is directed by Nia DaCosta, is more straightforward, formally, in terms of like, here's a story, we're going to tell it. It's still very weird. This is still a very weird movie. And I'm just going to borrow from my written review here because apologies if you've already read it, but I feel like I kind of captured that weirdness pretty well. So I'm me quoting myself. Sonny, this is Sonny Bunch, reading Sonny Bunch. I could describe the plot relatively succinctly. Spike, was played by Alfie Williams, who we saw in 28 years later, who we saw in 28 years later being rescued from the rage-infected zombies by a gang of youths dressed weirdly like pederast Jimmy Savile and called themselves the Jimmies, joins the gang. He joins the gang rather than die, and he watches in horror as the band of Satanists do terrible things to other survivors of the zombie apocalypse. The Jimmies eventually come into conflict with Dr. Ian Kelso, who is played by Ralph Fiennes, who built the titular ossuary and who has been trying to develop a cure for Samson that will bring him back to normalcy. If the rage virus is in fact a virus, it must have a cure. Kelson hopes to find it. Again, I could describe the movie this way. I guess I just did. And while this general description is more or less accurate, it obscures the incredible weirdness of The Bone Temple, which is, for a long stretch of the film, a buddy comedy. There's really no other way to explain the relationship between Kelson and Samson. And The Bone Temple only really works because Ralph Fiennes commits so completely to the bit, right? Like, you absolutely buy him as a hermit whose mind has been warped by the loneliness he is facing, into hoping that there's still a chance for the alpha whose rage he has soothed by enormous doses of morphine. Indeed, long stretches of this picture involve nothing zombie-oriented at all, really. It's just Kelson, who has turned his open-air ossuary into an open-air opium den, and he and his big naked friend are rolling around in the grass, stoned out of their minds, letting the world wash over them.
Like but with zombies.
End my own quote there. My main takeaway from this is that Ralph Fiennes absolutely deserves an Oscar nomination, and he won't get one. But he is incredibly funny and charming and kind-hearted as the iodine-covered doctor, justice for Ralph Fiennes. Peter, what did you make of 28 years later, The Bone Temple?
I didn't think of that that subplot so much as being like a buddy comedy. It's actually more like a rom-com, right? There is a sort of like a romantic tension, and maybe that's just true in buddy comedies as well, but there is an odd romantic tension. I mean, they're like just sort of hanging out in the meadow. Duran Duran is playing, like, they're looking up at the sky, they're smiling, they're happy, like, they're getting to know each other, right? This is it is practically a meet cute, not quite falling in love, but they are falling for each other in some sense. And it's a pretty weird and fascinating sort of emotional core to the film, right? That to have the relationship here between a scientist and his zombie subject. But that story is the contrast to the story of the Jimmies. And the story of the Jimmies is, I think, the way into figuring out what this movie's really about. This movie is about the devil. Turns out the devil is just a guy named Jimmy, right? And Jimmy walks around wearing mostly black. His tracksuit is very dark. He's got gold chains, but he specifically has an upside down cross that is a big upside down cross that hangs from his gold chain. This is a symbol of the devil, right? And his origin, his zombie origin story that we saw in the first film involves a priest, right? And a church. And he has taken sort of, a kind of anti-church, anti-God, right? Kind of, he is literally a Satanist. He calls himself to his followers that he says he's the son of old Nick. He said, basically telling them, the devil is my father and we are here to do the devil's work. And so this is, I think, what Alex Garland is doing here is he is, as he often does, using this sort of state of nature, this kind of anarchic state in which you have a world that has been overrun by zombies, in which the ordinary rules no longer apply. Well, then what do humans do? Well, some of them become deeply evil, and some of them try to use science to make friends and to cure things and to bring progress to the world. And so this story is, I think, fundamentally a story about the clash between science and secularism and a sort of religiously, you know, a spiritually inflected vision of evil. And it is an argument that evil isn't spiritual, that there is no devil in this sort of cosmic Catholic sense, the kind you can't see. No, it's just Jimmy and his knives and the way he takes them to people's bodies. And so I found this movie's just fascinating in so many ways. And it's an interesting little, it almost acts as a coda to the first 28 years later, right? This is a sort of, this is quite a footnote, but it's just sort of, this is the epilogue to that film. But that film was asking in some ways a different question about what happens in the state of nature, which is, you know, sort of how do people come together to form society and family? And how does that sort of play out, not just in the human world, but in the zombie world as well, right? And this is just a film that is very straightforwardly about what is the nature of evil. Is the nature of evil something spiritual that sort of comes down and descends upon you and has kind of a, you know, godlike, devilish, you know, force that cannot be explained? Or can it in fact just be explained that some people are very evil and choose to do evil things and then try to pull other people into their orbit to enact their evil desires. And so this movie, you know, I mean, very clearly settles on this extremely disenchanted, humanistic, secular worldview of what evil is and what good is. And in that respect, I mean, it's maybe not entirely far from my own worldview, but it's fascinating that you get this sort of crazed zombie movie that is a philosophical investigation into anarchy and the nature of evil. And now we've got how many of these? The third one that Alex Garland has written?
Yeah, I it's funny. I wrote in my notes as I was watching the movie, halfway through the movie, like, oh, this movie is about how society reconstitutes itself or how society, you know, kind of keeps itself together in the face of horror. And I really appreciated Alex Garland making that subtext text in the actual coda to this film, in which the Cillian Murphy's character appears and he is delivering a lecture about the end of World War One and how the punitive measures after the imposed upon the Germans led to World War Two and how people needed to work together and the Marshall Plan rebuilt Europe and everyone, you know, you turn Germany and Japan into allies instead of enemies. And you end the scourge of nationalism and populism, et cetera. It was not subtle. It was not a subtle thing that happens at the end of this movie. Alyssa, what did you make of 28 years later, The Bone Temple?
I came very close to not making it through this movie. the sort of central flaying scene is just like, that does not, I have a very, very hard time with that. But I'm
for
glad
record,
that
I tried to warn you. I warned you that there's lots of totally stabbing warned. Violence in this movie.
I was warned, but it's like, I mean, look, doing this podcast with you guys has stretched my tolerance a lot. But I would still say this was at the sort of very, very edge of what I am able to even sit through, like with my eyes closed and like my ears covered. But I'm glad I made it through. Both because I think the sort of climactic sequence here where Ralph Fiennes basically puts on a show where he pretends to be the devil is, I really struggle to think of something more entertaining or surprising that either I have seen at the cinema in the last 5 years or will see in the next 10. It is so delightful and weird and high stakes and just like, it's gonzo, right? It is completely sui generis and I loved it. But I also think this is a movie, you know, Peter, you were talking about how it's a movie that is very sort of humanistic and about where evil comes from. But it is also a movie that really affirms that, you know, people have choices and sometimes they make good ones, and that it is rarely too late to make a good choice, right? I mean, we haven't talked at all about the character of Jimmy Ink, one of the two sort of female Jimmys who, you know, initially seems very sort of resigned to her position within the sadistic gang, right? I mean, when Spike initially sort of runs away from this scene of torture in this farmhouse, she says to him, you know, this is what we do. You know, there is no better option. This sort of is the tribe that we have. The world is a disaster. And over the course of the movie, she makes a set of very different choices, right? I mean, she lies for Spike. She protects him. She comes up with the idea that Kelson is the devil in a way to sort of delay Spike's punishment. And ultimately, she helps end Sir Jimmy Crystal's reign of terror. And she becomes sort of a surrogate mother for Spike after the loss of his mother in the previous movie. Right? And, you know, it's weird to describe the evolution of a homicidal maniac as sort of touching, but it is touching, right? It's like she, by connecting with another person in sort of a genuine and maternal way, ends up freeing not just herself, but a lot of other people from this genuine force of evil. She does it in, you know, violent, gross and upsetting way. Crucifixion is also high on my list of things that I do not want to watch on screen. But she does it. And, you know, Kelson makes a choice to sort of take a gamble on the idea that Samson is not going to kill him, right? Like, he puts down his blowpipe, and it's not just that, but, you know, Samson shows up in search of morphine, but he shows up in search of treatment, right? Like, he's been shot by arrows. Kelson treats him. He is willing to gamble on the possibility of someone else's goodness, right? Samson chooses to treat Kelson's, you know, body with dignity and respect. Spike chooses to treat, to trust Jimmy Ink when he doesn't necessarily have to. And so, you know, I think it is human. This is a humanist movie, not just in the sense that, you know, we are responsible for our choices, but also that we're capable of making them and we're capable of making good ones. You know, I found just the sort of surprise of Kelson as a character in last year's 28 Years Later, just one of the most deeply touching things I saw at the movies. And I think this movie really deepens that, even if I had to sit through a lot of flaying to get there.
I'll say that whole middle sequence is sort of interesting because there's not much going on. I mean, in some ways, right, this movie doesn't have a whole lot of plot to it. It's like, there's just two sort of lines. There's, you know, Spike joins the Jimmys and the Jimmys do a bunch of torturing. And the torturing takes a long time, too long for Alyssa. And then at the same time, you got Dr. Kelson and Samson, and they're just hanging out, you know, doing drugs, talking about science like you do. And that's it until the third act, right? There's just those two things. There's not a whole lot of story here. And yet it actually, you know, somehow or another, these two lines, you know, they're going to converge. You kind of know what's, you don't know what's going to happen. But you have some sense that there's these two worldviews and styles are going to come into conflict. But the movie just sort of goes like that for like an hour.
And I would say that part of what's interesting about Kelson's intuition about how to treat Samson is that his guess is that the virus has sort of taken away Samson and the other zombies' ability to sort of perceive and process information and make choices, right? Like what his guess that turns out to be accurate is that this is a form of psychosis that makes Samson and the other zombies see everyone as threats, like see other people as themselves, right?
I mean, and, we know it's more than a guess because we actually see an early moment in an early attack that the zombies are seeing the humans as monsters.
Right. And what he restores to Samson is the ability to, you know, process information correctly, to assess things and make choices. He essentially
to become
Samson
human
free will back.
Again. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, again, this is all explained very nicely at the end of the film by Cillian Murphy, who I was honestly like mildly frustrated by that coda. It's one of the reasons I keep coming back to it, because like, again, I like Alex Garland a lot. I rewatched Civil War after watching 28 years later, The Bone Temple, and which is again a movie I like a lot. I think it's really good, but it is not a subtle film. There is literally a line in the film where Kirsten Dunst's character is like, "I went to all of these war zones and I shot them in Civil War, and I thought I was sending a lesson back here for it not to happen here, and here we are." And it's just like, it's like I almost wish there was like a little neon sign that would pop up on the screen when this is happening saying, "This is the theme. Yep. This is the message. Just
take
button. This home." mash that like button here. If you like how we're describing how he describes the themes, hit that like button. Restack this with a note.
Meryl Streep turning to the camera, taking off her wig and saying, "It's time for campaign finance reform."
I have so much doubt. I have so much doubt. Another Meryl Streep movie. But again, that is the theme of the film, and I think it's really well done when it's not being kind of ham-handed. Is that look, you are faced with choices in life as to the society you want to make for yourself. Do you want to have the chaos of the strong destroying the weak, or do you want to have one where we try and rebuild everything together? And these two ideas are in tension. They coexist in the real world as we see it all the time, but they cannot coexist within a society. You kind of have to choose one. That is the lesson of this film. And it's pretty, pretty poignant and meaningful one at this moment. I will say, just in terms of the performances in this film, A, Ralph Fiennes is great. B, the guy who plays Samson, whose name escapes me at the moment, who is a 6'8" former MMA fighter, is also really good. There's this very funny moment in the film where he's like regaining his kind of consciousness and his humanity, and he finds himself on a train as if he's going to work. And other zombies are about to attack him, and he snaps out of it. He's like, "I don't have a ticket." And then it goes into like zombie action mode, and it's just wonderful. It's a delightfully funny scene. It's like a very Britishly funny scene, in its own way. But the performances of the Jimmies are also very good and interesting. Both of the female Jimmies are very impressive, and I gotta say I'm Jack O'Connell.
Yeah,
I don't know how to describe his performance. To say I like it is maybe the wrong thing to say, but he's just delightfully insane in this.
Yep.
And he has put together a real like era defining run here over between these two 28 years films and Sinners. He has put together a real era defining run of like deranged, insane horror villains it's yeah, good
like
for
calm
him.
Psychosis. It's very unnerving. He scares the bejesus out of me. It'll be really interesting to see him like try to do a rom-com or some sort of, you know, historical movie or biopic where, and everyone's just gonna be like, that guy's gonna eat me. He's gonna eat my face. I don't know what to do. Ah!
Sort of seems like they should pair him with Glenn Powell. Not like that Glenn Powell and him should be the two male interests in a rom-com, right? That you can just totally imagine them playing up, like being the thesis, antithesis, yin and yang playing off of each other, right? The sort of extremely wholesome golden boy, and then the other one who is like somehow or another like extremely bad boy, but also enticing for it. Casting directors, right. Call me. I've got more plot, but you're gonna have to pay for it.
I don't know if that's I don't know. Well, I'm not sure about that. All right. So, what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, Alyssa?
Thumbs up, though. It is absolutely at the edge of my endurance.
Peter?
Thumbs up. First great movie of the year.
Thumbs up. Again, it's very different. It's different from the first one, but it is still very weird. It's very unusual. I liked it a lot. It is worth, you got to go see it just for Ralph Fiennes' performance, who is absolutely fantastic in this year. I'm already penning my Ralph Fiennes got snubbed essay for 14 months from now when he doesn't get an Oscar nomination. So
best,
I'm going to just stick that, gonna,
Iron
gonna
Maiden.
Stick that in my filing cabinet.
Best keep, use of Iron Maiden in a movie, maybe ever.
Ever.
Yeah. Very funny. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Munch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday. Hopefully.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.